Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, and thank you for joining us for Three Women, Three Ways. We are the show that tackles some pretty tough topics sometimes. Today, the topic's not quite so tough, at least not so emotionally tough, I don't think, but it is a topic that we need to be aware of. We oftentimes, again, nobody wants to mention open technology today. There we go. We are talking about the role of technology in abuse, in intimate partner abuse, but we're talking about it not from the standpoint of necessarily just how can that technology be used to abuse, but we're also talking about other ways technology comes into the whole dynamic of intimate partner abuse. We have with us today Jen Doe. Jen, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Jen is the peer education director. Well, she's actually the she oversees a peer education program that puts high school-aged youth and educates them about the dynamics of relationship abuse. And you have come to this from my alma mater, from the University of Colorado, Denver, from the Masters of Public Administration, from the Department of Gendered Violence, right? The Program on Gendered Violence?
Correct.
Okay. So you've studied gendered violence.
I have. I have, and I'm also a survivor of domestic violence.
Okay. And what brought you to have an interest in the technology aspect of it?
I think, you know, working with teenagers especially, technology is plays a huge role in their lives, and so I hear a lot of different ways that technology plays into intimate partner abuse as well as bullying and just other day-to-day dynamics. And then the organization that I work with puts on an annual day-long training symposium, and this past April, the focus of that was all about technology. So really got to hear from a lot of different speakers and learn about a lot of the different ways that technology is used as a tool for abuse, as well as positive ways that it can be used to, you know, create a more positive online culture or even apprehend abusers in some cases.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we're going to get into that more. And we also have with us Dr. Joanne Belknap. Joanne, thank you for coming with us.
Thank you, Heather.
You're one of the co-authors of the studies that kind of triggered this whole topic today. What triggered your interest in the role of technology in intimate partner abuse?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all, Heather, and also I'm really appreciating that you're doing this because I, like you and Jen, think this is a huge problem. What happened was I'd been doing research, I think, for about 15 years on intimate partner abuse, and actually I would just want to make a point that I like to use the term intimate partner abuse instead of domestic violence or intimate partner violence because one of my main drives is how much of this is not violent per se but is still very threatening and degrading, and which is demeaning, which is a lot of what I want to talk about today. But this first started because I had this funding from the National Institute of Justice through Violence Against Women Act monies in Cincinnati. I was teaching at the University of Cincinnati at the time. And when I was going through all the police reports for 1998, so this was some time ago, and reading them, I was really struck with police writing down things like that the victim was hit with the phone. These were the days when people didn't have cell phones and when most phones had cords. Victims were being strangled with the cords of the phone and then having their phone stolen. And it was mostly anecdotal because it wasn't something that they were supposed to just check on there. So I couldn't tell how frequent it was because it just depended on whether that particular responding officer wrote it down. But it really chilled me to think that phones are this access to call 911. They're the access for the most part, for the prosecutors to call and say what's going on, or the detectives. for other health agencies, sisters, mothers, family members. And so that it was this real using somebody's lifeline, the abuser using the lifeline to actually further harm her and abuse her. And so I just got really interested in that. So I would talk about it when I was giving presentations. And it was one time when I was giving a presentation, a physician who worked in the emergency room said, I can't tell you how many times we see that coming in, that one of the weapons, and again, this was anecdotal, was the phone that he hit her with in the head. And so then fast forward a few years after that, when Anne DePrince and I got this grant, another NIJ, Violence Against Women Act funded grant in Denver. By then it was more cell phones and a lot more people had their own computers and so on. But I said, let's put in here what's going on with their computer and phone access. And so that's so when the paper that we published on that along with Anne Chu a couple of years ago, and I'm happy to send this to any of the listeners if anybody's interested in looking at the article. I'm happy to email it to you if you want to email me. But you know, we looked at what's going on here. So, and then when I met Jen, we actually met because of we were both working. I was a member of her thesis committee, and then I didn't realize she was a survivor till later when I heard her story, which is truly incredible. And Jen is truly incredible. But one of the things that happened with her too is that, and of course Jen can talk more about this, but that her abuser did not use violence for a long time until the very, very end. But one of the things he did was destroy her computer. And so I feel like these things about technology are so important because they're the lifelines to ask for help. There are ways usually of phones and computers to find out when our court dates are and so on, and then we blame women when they don't show up for their court dates. But that was another thing that really struck me in the original study in Cincinnati was how many of the women, the prosecutors would complain they couldn't get hold of them and their phones were out of order or they just had gone AWOL. And I just kept wondering, well, how many of these were women who'd had their phones stolen, broken, or whatever from their abusers. So I've gone on quite a bit here. I'll be quiet for a minute.
Oh, that's okay. I was taking a couple little notes, and when you first started out, you were literally talking about using technology as a weapon, to physically using it, the phone cord, the mechanical. That hadn't crossed my mind. I mean, I suppose, you know, that's not necessarily a conscious use of that technology as a weapon, but nevertheless, it's accessible and it's grabbed and used as a weapon. Hadn't thought of that.
And I'm not sure it's not conscious because
really?
I feel like
okay.
Some of the things abusers will say is no one's going to be able to help you. You are completely dependent on me and you're not going to be able to call anybody. So I don't think it's always conscious, but I think it is. And go ahead.
Oh, I meant that, you know, you were using the example of the telephone cord for use for strangulation. Do you think that was literally a conscious, you know, that was just handy and so he used it for strangulation? Or do you think that was also part of a message, I'm using this for my weapon because of certain reasons?
I think it is either conscious or subconscious, and I don't know. But I was thinking, when I read child abuse cases, I don't read where they use the phones to hit them so much. And I don't I don't know. And, you know, what you hear a lot of times in child abuse cases, you'll see that they hit them with cords, like electrical cords. It'll, you know, something that's easily accessible and it was easy. So I think in that case, that would make more sense. But with the phones, and I don't know, and I could be wrong, but while I was writing, actually when I was going to present this paper at Duke Law School, which is the journal that published it, was when it was a famous case of a soccer player who was murdered by her, and I just forgot her name, her last name was Love, but she had been murdered by her boyfriend maybe it was lacrosse, and he had actually hit her, one of his weapons was hitting her with her laptop, and my reading of some of the stuff on this was there was some indication that there was things about him on her laptop. So I don't know, but I definitely think this needs more research and more looking into.
Yeah, yeah. Huh, interesting. Okay, so, you know, maybe that connection isn't a real, real strong one, but it sounds like it might be there. At least it's worth investigating. We were talking about this on before we went on air. There's so many things that we suspect, but the research isn't there. I would love to see some sort of research institute solely on, you know, these kinds of issues so that they could fund research and you know, but that's me. Okay, so
me too. Jen,
in your experience, have you seen this use of technology to abuse, and at what levels?
Yes, I mean, I think the kind of more typical ways that we hear are stalking and monitoring, or, you know, not giving someone access to that kind of outside communication. I think the concept of revenge porn, or this new tool, is becoming more and more frequently heard about, where they're, for whatever reason, the abuser will have digital images of the victim. Whether or not those images were consensually taken kind of varies, but at the point that the relationship ends, then those images become a tool of exploitation. So that's something that I think I'm just seeing a lot more in all age ranges as well. And then in working with youth, definitely sexting is a huge part of culture, and there's a lot of coercive behavior that goes along with that, and kind of a lot of status, if you will, that kind of plays into that issue. So that's kind of, those are the most common trends I'm seeing with people that I've worked with, or people that my colleagues are working with. And then, as Joanne mentioned, in my personal experience, yeah, my computer was, it wasn't actually destroyed, but he did attempt to destroy it in an assault that occurred right at the point of separation when I said that I was leaving the relationship. And at the time, I was a student in art school. And so my computer was a symbol of my independence. You know, it contained all of these projects that I had been working on over the course of several months, and it was very, very intentional that he went after that, even though he wasn't severely physically violent toward me. There were things, including he did destroy the phone when I tried to make a call, but then really the computer was where he focused on, because that was something that he could take away from me, and he knew it would have a huge impact.
So we're seeing the use of we're seeing abusers go toward technology, not literally as a physical weapon. We're seeing them go toward, you know, technology as a way to isolate, and then we're also seeing them go toward it as a way to punish, what help me with the words that I'm looking for.
Well, so in some ways as a weapon, I would say, but also, so it can be physically as a weapon, but also, like, to me, and Jen, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, I mean, to me, Jen's computer was so symbolic because it was where she had most of her work for her degree, and so it really was this representation of her independence and her own thing that was separate from her abuser. And what was very important to her, what she was working so hard on. So it was,
and
it was,
think,
you know, yeah, go ahead.
You know, there was some part of him that knew that it wasn't okay to physically abuse me. And so that was the kind of alternative that he found that in many ways, you know, would cause more harm than having actually hit me. I mean, this was the middle of my first semester of art school. So literally I could have flunked out of school as a result of him destroying all of the work that I had been doing.
Yeah. And, so another a form of sabotage.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris Sullivan and some of her colleagues have talked about economic abuse, which I think fits into this, where they'll talk about things like the abuser doing things like hiding the car keys so that their partner, their victim, is always late to work or to school or these different things. And I think, you know, and phones are just this phones and computers are just this other way to do this. In our Denver study, one of the things we found was that a number of the women reported was their abusers sending viruses to their phone, their laptops,
wow.
and so on. And so that, and a lot of times, no, and, you know, we know this. A lot of times, women will go into direct poverty from leaving an abuser, which is one of the reasons that keeps them in there. But these were the kind of things, and really heartrending stories of some of the women I've talked to about them not being able, you know, having these custody issues, and they can't afford to call their lawyers, and or can't call their lawyers, and you know, I just it's. You know, and then in the Denver Domestic Fatality Review Committee that Jen and I both work on, I mean, one of the cases there, I was just all of them are horrible cases, but these are all domestic violence cases where there was a murder or attempted murder. And one of the cases was this woman who had left her abuser and had an 8-year-old son. And my memory is she had moved back to Texas, where she was from, but it was definitely out of state of Denver. And her ex-husband, her abuser, got to see their 8-year-old son once a month for the weekend. And he was, while he was there, of course, the abuser would, and I shouldn't say of course, but we see this pattern a lot of using that to try to lure her to come back to him when she called to talk to her son. And her son didn't have his own phone, so she would have to call her former husband, her abuser. And he said to her on the phone, "You really need to take me back." And she said, "I'm not going to." And he shot and killed their son while he was on the phone with her. So in some ways, I think these cases can be very emotionally extreme. And like Jen said, her ex-husband punching her in the middle of the semester would probably have had a lot less of a ramification than if he had destroyed her computer. And so my concern is that as a society, we don't take this seriously. We don't take the destruction of pets and property of victims seriously. And the criminal legal system doesn't take it seriously. And yet they are such red flags for control and abuse. And they do have, they can have such massive ramifications.
You know, well, you were talking about the man who killed his son while on the phone. It made me flash back to several years ago. Was it Jack Kerouac? There was a famous author who literally committed suicide while on the phone with his wife.
Oh, boy. Which I think is very abusive. No, I don't remember him doing that, but that wouldn't surprise me.
And I might be wrong here, but for some reason Jack Kerouac comes to mind. So maybe I'm wrong with that. But at the time, everybody that I knew was talking about how this was such a cry for help, and oh, how sad, you know, and my red flags just were going off all over the place going, why did he do this to his wife?
Yeah. And one of the things we see that really regularly in the in all the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Committee see that there is such a strong pattern of the men who kill their wives and girlfriends, including former ones, have many of them have a history of threatening suicide. And then we see a lot of them actually do suicide after they kill them. But it gets back to some of the earliest work that Jackie Campbell and some other people did on intimate partner homicides, that when you interview both, and I'm assuming a different sex couple here because that's what most of the research was done on, but the limited stuff on same-sex couples, we can see the same thing. But what we see a lot of times is that both of them, like a bunch of these first articles on this were called Till Death Do Us Part, and these different kind of things we hear from marriage vows, which, you know, thinking about the cultural part of this, but a lot of the more advanced where there's really extreme violence and abuse in a couple's relationship that had been going on for years, when interviewers would ask both of them separately, what will it take for this abuse to stop? Both the abuser and the victim, their answer would be, when one of us dies. Like, this is so much, nothing can stop this. Because it's that strong. And I'm not saying that it can't always not stop it. And I'm imagining there are some people listening to this radio show right now that are in abusive relationships my experience in teaching, I've been teaching for 30 years at the college level. I do a lot of workshops and so on. My experience is that a lot of victims who are currently being victimized don't identify what's happening to them as domestic violence, intimate partner violence, intimate partner abuse, whatever we want to call it, unless there's actual violence when there are these incredibly controlling behaviors going on. And certainly phones and computers are a key way of doing that. I've had college students who their boyfriends, you know, want all of their passwords to their email, to their, you know, if they have a password to their phone so they can check on everything. And it's a very, very controlling thing to do. And then they get, you know, and we know that abusers, some of the main characteristics about them are that they are, the two main characteristics is they're very jealous and they're very controlling. And those two things go together really well too. So, of course, monitoring somebody's, your victim's email and text messages and phone messages and so on is certainly an extremely controlling thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up a good point. I'm a little negligent in giving out our phone number. If you'd like to join us in our conversation, or if you have an anecdote or a situation that you'd like to share with us, our call-in number is 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. Just call in if you have a question or a comment. We also have our chat room open, and you can just go there and type in a question or a comment, and we'll be happy to share that with our guests. And I see we do have a couple of people in the chat room, so feel free to just come out with a couple of questions for us. So, okay, let's back up a little bit here. So you became interested in doing this research. Were there any surprises that you found when you were doing this research, Joanne?
You know, one of them was that, I've been in doing this work for a long time, and I started back in, oh my gosh, I think 1981, I started volunteering, trying to start a safe house in Grand Canyon, Colorado. And so I've been doing this for a long time. One of the things that did surprise me was, at the beginning, when caller ID first became technologically possible, a lot of my friends that are victim advocates and were at that time for women who were in abusive relationships, they were like, oh my God, this is the worst thing. And then that was one of the things that kind of like, actually, no, this is a good thing because you know that's who's calling. So I feel like sometimes there are these things that we kind of don't really expect. One of the things that really surprises me and continues to surprise me is we put so much blame on women if their partners have been arrested for domestic violence for not showing up in court. Legally, you see these words like a non-cooperative victim, a reluctant victim. So we see these things without looking at how frightening some of these women's cases are. But also, I mean, one of the things that just drives me absolutely crazy is we have these 911 calls, and yet they are rarely used in court. It is almost so here's this way that you don't have to put the victim on the stand. And some of them are kids calling. Some of them are neighbors calling. And so we have this way that, I mean, all the 911 tapes are taped by the dispatchers. And so here's this great source of technology and data, evidence, that we don't use, but then we blame these women when they don't call their prosecutors back. So those are the kind of things that did surprise me, and I just thought it doesn't matter what these women do, they're not going to get helped. I mean, and that isn't completely true. I don't believe that there are a lot of us trying to make this system better, including both of you on this phone. But that was one thing I would just say. The caller ID, actually, I think, Jen, if you think differently, or Heather, you do, I think that it's a useful thing because you can see that that's who's calling, unless, of course, they use somebody else's phone.
Yeah, there's ways around it if they're smart enough.
Other
thing that I think is interesting is that star 69, where it will just tell you who called.
Yes.
You know, what number called you so that you have
you
a
might
track
want to
that.
Explain that to the audience, too, if for any women that might or men who might be in an abusive
okay.
relationship now. I think that is good.
Work. Yeah, it doesn't always work because I think they can block it just like they can with anything else. But many
right.
times it does work. You get a phone call and it'll be a hang up or it'll be somebody who doesn't identify themselves. And as soon as you hang up, if you immediately pick up the telephone back, you know, open the phone again and hit *69, you'll get a mechanical voice saying your last phone call was from this number and it says the number. And then it'll ask you if you want to call it back and all that kind of stuff. But you'll get the number of the person who called you unless they've managed to block it. And that's really helpful as well, because if you have that their number, then there are ways you can track it down to their name as well. So that whole *69 thing and caller ID are godsends. But, again, there's ways to block it. So,
right.
Jen, has it been your experience, what Joanna's saying about the use of technology as a methodology for abuse? Have you seen that in your work experience?
Yeah, definitely. I've seen, I've seen a whole range of things, lots of scenarios where an abuser would put a virus or put spyware or some sort of tracking information on a victim's computer or hack into their social media accounts, even create false profiles and try to connect with the victim's friends and family under the guise of being someone else in order to gain access to that victim. And also a lot of breaking of the phone, which I've heard a lot of advocates say when they have a victim come to them and say, he broke my phone, they think, great, let's get you a new phone and a new phone number, and now he can't call you anymore. Like, it's one of those things where that could be a positive thing, but is definitely a piece of the abuse. And going back to, what I was saying previously, I do think that if I had been punched, say, or physically abused in a way that I identified as abusive, then it would have certainly made it easier for me to break from that relationship more quickly and cleanly. I ultimately did, but the fact that the abuse was directed at objects and things like that really did make it harder for me to recognize what was going on, because it wasn't that picture of domestic violence or intimate partner abuse that had been painted for me by media and things like that. So I definitely agree with Joanne that this is one of these types of abuse that we really tend to downplay. And in talking with teenagers, having each other's, having your partner, your boyfriend or girlfriend's passwords to their phone is completely normal.
Wow.
That is a symbol of trust, and that this is something that is very normalized, as we share this information because we trust each other and things like that. Or if my partner is wanting to monitor my phone, that jealousy is how I know that they love me.
You're
so,
kidding me. That makes me so sad.
Yeah.
I was an expert witness on a case once where the abuser would it would be when they were making up, okay, give me the password to your email account, and he actually emailed her professor and told her professor that, pretending it was his partner, saying that her mother had died and that she was really upset, and then her professor writes back this email, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And so this woman told me when I interviewed her, she actually walked into the professor's office and her abuser, another college student, escorted her there to the professor's office. And she had written on a piece of paper, this is all a lie, I'm afraid of him, he's outside this door right now. But she said then she just became too afraid to give it to the professor, and she thought it just made it look like she was crazy. And so the professor kept saying, I'm so sorry about your mom, and she couldn't stop crying. And I just think all of these, it can be so twisted. And I'm glad you brought up the suicide thing, because I don't know, Jen, if you hear that with the age group you're working with, but I definitely hear it from the college students a lot.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
And a lot of times it's calls and text messages, I'm going to kill myself if you, I would kill myself if you broke up with me. So I think that's an incredibly abusive thing for somebody to say to somebody else. That's putting a huge, you know, even if people have been married 50 years and somebody decides to leave, it isn't their fault if the other person kills themselves. And we just have such strong cultural messages about all of this. And certainly it's very gendered and sexist that women and girls are supposed to take care of men and boys, and especially their very fragile egos. And it's very dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
One of the things that was crossing my mind here as you two were talking, I thought, you know, we did a show, maybe even a year ago with the hotline. It was on the anniversary for the domestic violence hotline, they were talking about how the trends have changed, so that now they have about half of their responses as actual physical phone calls, and about half of the people who contact them are doing it through technology.
Wow.
So when I, you know, through a chat room or whatever, and so they were talking about how their demand has changed and how their needs have changed. When I see this, I, of course, think age. It's the young people who are using technology more than the old people. But is that really a fact? Jen, is that what you see? Because it seems to me that with some of the older women, we're still, you know, they're still using telephones. They're still using, you know, certain technologies that are very common. So are you seeing, Jen, that a difference in the ages? You mentioned especially the young people, but is it a huge gap?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The, you know, high school age students that I work with they're on their phones all the time, but mostly they're chatting or messaging, text messaging, Snapchatting. They're using even images to communicate with each other and using all of these different apps, where even myself, I mean, I'm 32, and so I've only had a cell phone for about 10 years, but at this point I'm more likely to text someone than call them. It's just more comfortable. And I actually operate a text line as part of my job, so I often have teenagers who will text me for advocacy, for questions, versus calling a hotline. It's just, it's a more accessible language for them, and in a lot of cases, there's also a safety element to that, right? There, I had one student once actually say to me, you know, if I'm hiding in my closet or, you know, whatever, I can text you and no one will know, but I don't want someone to overhear me talking on the phone to someone. So that was a really interesting kind of positive twist there as well, that it can sometimes be a little bit more discreet to send a text message or something like that. And there are all of these like safety apps that are out there now as well, like Circle of Six and things like that, where you can, with the push of a button on your cell phone, you can actually alert a network of people that you've predetermined to danger, you know, some sort of distress. So I think there are a lot of ways that technology has positive impacts when we're talking about this issue, but I think we're also still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, and it also, I think, create, you know, I mean, I can really see the positive things of being able to, you know, hide and text and all that, but does it have any psychological impact? I mean, it seems to me that it would be harder to go to somebody for help if you've never even heard their voice.
I think there's an anonymity to that that's actually kind of comforting.
I agree with that, too. I think a lot of times, I mean, I agree with Jen, and I think that's one of the reasons having victim advocates and all these different means of accessing help is so important, because, and it's kind of like just how we, you know, humans were different in a lot of ways. Like, you know, one of the ongoing discussions I have with my students is whether you're more likely to lash out at strangers when you're in a bad mood, or you're, or the people you love the most. Like, you know, some of us are just feel more comfortable. I like to think I don't do it much anyway, but some people, you know, are much just more likely to, when they're in a bad mood, to snap at strangers than they are their loved ones. And other people are the exact opposite. And some people, you know, some of the research on intimate partner abuse has found that sometimes some people would rather talk about it over the phone to an advocate than go in and meet with them. You know, other people don't want to talk on the phone. And so I, to me, the more we can have a lot of different things available, then we can adapt to more of the needs and just a lot more resources of different types of technology, including the in-person. How do we make that all possible?
Yeah. I was reading, of course, you know, I mean, I'm older than you, Jen, and you know, so I'm definitely at that age where I use technology, and I, you know, I mean, I'm texting during the day and all that kind of stuff, but my gut feeling is more toward the in-person. You know, for customer service, for example, it's bringing me to my knees that you can't actually contact a person if you have a problem with a product or a service.
Sure.
You email somebody and, you know, oh, 3 days later you get an email back that doesn't say anything and then you have to email back and blah, 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 you know. And I am of the era where give me the phone, I'll tell this person this problem, we can resolve it right now. But my children are definitely of the era of, you know, why do you want to talk to people on the phone? That's just weird. So I understand what you're saying about that. But I also wonder about the implications. I mean, so much of what women who have gone through abuse experience happens after the abuse. It's what we're left with. It's the residue that we carry with us for the rest of our lives. Is that different if you have a person who has relied on technology for assistance as opposed to someone who does more of the in-person? Or do you know? Is that an impossible question?
Yeah, I guess I don't know specifically. But, I mean, I do think that technology gives us these opportunities to connect with people in ways that we haven't. I for instance, know someone who is a parent of a child with albinism, and she has been able to connect with lots of other parents who are dealing with the same issue through Facebook groups and through different means of technology. So although isolation is often a big part of what we see in intimate partner abuse, technology can help to bridge that gap by giving people access to, I don't know, other networks of people who are going through similar things where, you know, maybe you can't find an in-person support group that you want to go and attend or you don't feel comfortable that way. And I think often people do avoid those sorts of things out of fear of being judged or, you know, feeling like no one's going to understand their story. And so being able to do that from a distance is a way to protect yourself and to kind of feel things out. And technology also gives you the opportunity to kind of think through what you want to say before you say it. Whereas if you're on the phone, you're having to kind of come up with things in the moment. And if you're sending an email or a text message, you know, you can wait and you can really think about what you want to say and write out exactly how you want it to sound. So,
on the other hand, then there is usually some sort of electronic track of what was done or said or the contact made, and that can also be a detriment, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. It worries me sometimes when I look at Facebook, and I do feel like this is an age thing, about how younger people are more likely to just throw their heart out there about their breakups. Mm-hmm. And I just, I always cringe when I see that, about worrying how vulnerable, I mean, most of us feel like that when we have been broken up with. But I'm just, to me, that's not the best place to do that unless you have a really small circle of friends on your Facebook. And even then, you don't know that somebody else can't do something with that. But that's another thing we've seen on the Denver Domestic Violence Fatality Review Committee. It's like we talked about before, an abuser making a whole new fake identity and friending their victim/survivor as a way to find out what they're up to. And it's really scary. Another thing that I just wanted to say, I think with the things like, you know, voicemail messages or text messages and all that thing, it is really important to save all of those if you can. And I'm sure most of the young people know this, but the screenshots of your phone of your text messages, you can just take screenshots and then like make a file of those, so you don't have to type them all up and they're there. But I don't think we've talked about stalking yet, even though that's basically a lot of what we're talking about. That stalking is the most common type of stalking is of current and former intimate partners, and it's mostly the former ones. And so certainly the social media, computers, phones are a really key way that stalking starts happening, and that. Some people can say, oh, no, I'm friends with them, or I just happen to be, on Facebook with them, or I didn't mean this when I texted it or whatever, but really being careful about all of that and learning, how we can block people and so on.
Jen, to your knowledge, do many advocacy programs, victims assistance programs offer information on how to block, how to save, how use technology to gather evidence?
I mean, I think to the best of their knowledge, SafetyNet through the National Network to End Domestic Violence is really kind of the national leader on technology and domestic violence. And so I know that advocates in the agencies that I've worked with use a lot of the resources from SafetyNet. And they have a lot of really, really great tips for various scenarios. Facebook has even put out a guide for survivors of domestic and sexual violence on kind of how to protect yourself online. Because I think another unfortunate thing that I've seen is that once you are a survivor of violence, it changes the way that you interact with technology, because now you have to be cautious of all of these things. You have to be careful about what information is out there about you, and that can be really disempowering for someone. I worked with a victim who has done a lot of speaking to the legislature and media interviews in regards to her circumstance, and her perpetrator is getting paroled, mandatory parole, within the next couple of years. And so I was working with her to just kind of start safety planning around what happens when he gets out. And the first thing we did was Google her name, and a lot of what came up was links to those media interviews. And so that was when I had to say, he's going to be able to see what you've been saying if he looks you up. So you have to consider that. And for her, it was really kind of jarring to hear, like, oh, I have to now be careful about what I'm saying and who I'm saying to and where I'm saying it, because this person is going to be able to access that.
But in fact, it's too late for her, because all of that stuff is already on there. He can already see that.
Yeah, and I mean, there are ways that you can request to have that information taken down, but it's, that's essentially, you just want to make yourself disappear then, which is not really what a survivor wants to do. That doesn't make sense as far as moving forward and regaining your power.
Well, and
it's kind of a sticky situation, I guess.
Yeah. In my case, I was advised by my attorney to be very careful about what I said, what the kind of speaking I did, and what kind of information I gave out. So that sounds like I had a pretty astute attorney at the time, because it was several years ago.
It's
also just, again, that double standard, too, that always bothers me about how you can't bring up, if there's a court case, his or her, the defendant's prior domestic violence. But then they'll just bring up all sorts of things about the victims. And we see this in rape cases, of course, too.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know, it's pretty remarkable.
Well, it's not a challenge, because if she's the victim, she's crazy. She started it. She was.
Yeah, she was supposed to control everything.
It's all her fault, I think one of the significant things about the conversation that we're having is that we're not talking about broken bones and bruises here.
Right.
We're talking instead about the vast majority of abuse that occurs, which is sometimes called coercive control, sometimes it's called, whatever name you attach to it. And I think that we can both agree, or all three of us can agree, that we've done a really crackerjack job over the last 30 years of educating people about broken bones and bruises. I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find anyone in our culture, in our society, who thinks it's just fine under any circumstances to hit a woman or hit, you know, a partner. But I don't think that you would find very many people who would find things wrong with this level of coercive control. And the dangerous thing that I am seeing about technology and this technological, you know, abuse via technology is that it is absolutely custom designed to continue coercive control. And I should have done my homework better and looked up the study, but there was a study, can't remember the author, that was a qualitative study that showed that women who had experienced physical abuse as well as coercive control, as well as the non-physical abuse, overwhelmingly said that if they had to experience it again, go ahead and hit me and break my bones, but don't make me go through that again, that coercive control stuff again. Are you familiar with that study, or am I being too loose with my
No,
reference?
I think even my memory is even as far back as some of the, Marie Tong, and I think even Lenore Walker, I think even talked about that too, that the cycle, that most women will say, if you typically what people talked about was psychological abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse, and that most women would say that the psychological abuse was the worst part. And part of it was that because it was so scary and threatening. And then, but other parts of it, that it was just really so hurtful. That, and one of the things Lenore Walker said, I mean, God, this was, I think, in 79, she said it's as if the abusers all went to the same training school, because their way to be, that so many of the women that were in her, that she was working with, would say that they would say that the women were bad mothers, they were fat, and they were ugly. And, I mean, and it was, you know, just to me that is such a slice of what is wrong with culture and sexism. And that, so that these very, very hurtful things, I mean, to call a woman a bad mother, it doesn't get much worse than that, right? And then
right.
In our society that's so thin, fat phobia, to call somebody a woman fat and so on. But one of the things that one of the researchers, and I think it was T.K. Logan, but I'm not positive, one of the things that she talked about with some of the verbal and psychological abuse was that your abusers, I mean, most of the time our intimate partners do know us, especially if we've been with them for a long time, better than anybody. So they know how to hurt us better than anybody, and to hurt us psychologically and emotionally better than anybody. So, I mean, they know what our most sensitive things are that we hate the most to be criticized about. And then, of course, that's what they'll use. So even if they say they're sorry later or whatever, they've already said it. Just like if they've already broken a bone, they can say they're sorry, but they've already broken the bone. So, and certainly to threaten to kill somebody, which the police very often don't take seriously, which is just mind-numbing to me, how that's just seen as a verbal, whereas a slap, they could be arrested. I saw that a lot in my own research, which I haven't done this as recently, so hopefully that's changing. But I've just been amazed at what kind of verbal threats people can make, or you're going to never see your children again.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that one's a good one. You leave me, you'll never see your children again.
Yep.
And then you're sitting there going, does that mean he's going to kill them? Does that mean he's going to take them away? Does that mean he's going to kill me? What does that mean? And that whole crazy-making thing that goes with that stuff.
Right.
So talking about, you know, that kind of terrorism that goes to the core of our being. I mean, when someone treats you that way, you're left with self-doubt, and even saying that is just such a mild milquetoast way of saying what you're left with. You're left with total questioning, total lack of confidence in any of your abilities, your way of thinking, anything. So it's really just destroys you from within, I think, that kind of coercive control. And when we're talking about using technology, what I'm seeing from your study, Jen, is that this is kind of like a mechanical recipe book for that kind of coercive control, the use of the technology. So it was interesting when we first started out, and the first thing you talked about was using technology, physically using the cords, the thing, you know, and mm-hmm. then to move on to the core of it. Do you think any of that is conscious, or do you think it's just, well, this is here, and this is what I'm going to do because this is what I know how to do?
I mean, I think it's conscious, but I don't think it's always conscious. And I think the part of using when, you know, to text something to somebody like you're the worst mother, or to put it on Facebook or some kind of public thing, you know, certainly that doesn't all have to be technology, but I think a lot of that technology thing, it's just so hurtful. And to take something that, you know, we all have things we're vulnerable about.
Yeah.
And so I think it is very purposeful. And I think, you know, and it's one of those things, okay, you can say you're sorry later. And, you know, and that I hate that expression, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. I mean, when we look at school bullying, I mean, most kids are a lot more traumatized from, you know, queer baiting and racist awful things and sexist awful things people say than they are from being hit, you know, from being ostracized, from being made fun of. That those are hugely damaging.
I keep saying that I'm going to write a book. Nobody uses title because I'm going to write this book. Sticks and stones may break my bones and words will hurt forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking back to the cases of revenge porn and find a survivor of domestic violence who's willing to speak on a panel or at an event is usually pretty easy. Survivors of revenge porn do not want to speak publicly. There's this element of humiliation that just runs so much deeper. And it is absolutely intentional, you know, for somebody to say, if you break up with me or if you don't do this, I'm going to share this image of you with your father or your pastor or your employer. I mean, that's very intentional and can have a huge impact on people's lives. And those never go away. So that can go on for years and years and continue to be a tool of control.
I wish I could remember her name, but the slut shaming, the woman who was slut shamed on the internet. And so what she did is she started a blog post about it, and she has just made it hers. Do you know who I'm talking about? She was on the show.
Yeah, I can't remember her name either.
Yeah, but she was on the show, and what a great, you know, I mean, she made, okay, fine. And then so she just made that hers. And, you know, mm-hmm. what a powerful position to take. Mm-hmm. Ladies, we can't end this conversation without talking about, so what do we do about this?
I think what Jen is doing, to me, it is so important to start with children that how we raise our children, how we, what they understand, that I've always felt like education and awareness are massive in this. And, you know, and a lot of times we assume that, you know, the boys that grow up with abusive fathers are going to be abusive. But, you know, some of them, I've met some of them, they saw how awful it was, and they're very invested in not being like that. But we need to have policy changes. I would love to see that 911 tapes routinely used in the court cases, in the, I don't know why they're not. I mean, in some cases, you know, there aren't always 911 tapes, but it's just really unusual to have them used. That's one thing I'd love to see. We need way more training of police and court personnel, and I would argue victim advocates, about the nonviolent, the coercive control, including the technology and how threatening and scary and demeaning and all these things it is. So those are some of the things that I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. What about you, Jen?
There are a couple organizations I know of that are specifically really targeting youth. We brought in a speaker from an organization called I Can Help. So the full name of the organization is I Can Help Stop Negativity, something like that. I'd be happy to share the link. But they basically are an organization who talks to kids, kind of meets them where they are, and says, you know, we know you're using this technology. Here are the things that you need to know about. Here are the things that you need to be concerned about. And here's what you can do when you see online bullying, when you see this kind of negative behavior. It's kind of, you know, how to be a positive upstander and change the culture of the internet, especially social media, things like that. So that's a great organization. Futures Without Violence has a project called It's Not Cool that is a really similar concept that really encourages young people to stand up and do something and say something when they see this kind of behavior online, because they are definitely seeing it more so than I am, absolutely. And I think laws definitely need to be improved around these issues related to sexting, coercive sexting especially, and revenge porn. They're one of the huge challenges is that it's very difficult to prosecute, to hold accountable the offenders of these kinds of crimes, because this has all changed and happened so quickly that we just don't have the laws in place to do anything about it. So either you're being charged with something like child pornography for sexting, or you're not being charged at all. And I think that's what we're seeing more commonly, is that there are just no charges being filed in a lot of these cases because they don't know what to do. And in some cases,
nobody's bleeding.
Yeah.
And we live in a very,
yeah.
You know, we go after who's bleeding. We don't, you know, so if there's no broken bones and bleeding, then we don't know what to do, and it's probably not that bad.
And I think it's also this victim blaming of why did they let those pictures be taken?
Of course.
So one of the things that encourages me about all of this conversation about technology is that it does tie in so absolutely strongly with that whole coercive control thing, which is an area. Now, you know that Great Britain passed legislation. In Great Britain, coercive control is a crime.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's great.
And it has been for about a year and a half now. And the buzz, I mean, the big conversation was, well, how do you know, everybody disagrees, everybody blah, how can you make this a crime, you know, but it's working for them. So why are we not doing something similar? Well, you know, because, I don't know, we're all doing what we can do, I guess. But what if I'm a victim of this? Do you have resources for me, Jen? Do you know, will the 800 number for the DV hotline be able to give resources if somebody's being having technology used against them in this way?
Possibly. I mean, I really think that most everyone that I have talked to about this issue will defer to the Safety Net Project at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. And there's a lot available online, tip sheets, fact sheets, but they're also very accessible people. They do training nationwide, maybe worldwide, as part of their job. So, you know, they're accessible for people to bring to their communities to train, and they're also accessible. If you have a question, you can call and talk to someone and get your questions answered in real time.
Wow. And that, again, is if I wanted to Google that, what would it be?
It's the Safety Net Project, and it's a project of NNEDV, the National Network to End Domestic Violence.
Wonderful. Okay, so if you're out there, probably not going to find a lot of help from friends, neighbors, when it comes to this kind of stuff, because we tend to kind of poo-poo and minimize stuff if we're not going through it. That's my experience anyway, and I know that's a gross generalization, but that's my experience. But you can go to this resource and get some help, at least to start a search for some help. We always end our show with a quote, and the quote that I have today is from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. It is from the NNEDV. The nearly 90% of programs report that survivors come to them for help after abusers intimidated, made threats via cell phone, text messages, and email, and 75% of programs noted that abusers accessed victims' accounts email, social media, etc., without the victim's consent and oftentimes without their knowledge. Intimidation, threats, and access of information about victims are not new tactics within the context of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and trafficking. However, the use of technology as a tool to facilitate these tactics means that the harassment and abuse can be much more invasive, intensive, and traumatizing. And I think that sums it up. Ladies, thank you so much for being
us
today. Join us next week. We're going to have Adrienne Hancock talking While Female, how we, women's language, gendered language, and how we monitor ourselves, how we edit ourselves as females when we're talking. Thank you so much. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, or Jen. Thank you, Joanne. Join us next week on Three Women, Three Ways.